first lecture this evening has been given by Alex Dubman, Professor of Philosophy in the Department of Visual Culture at Goldsmiths. As I'm sure you know, Alex is a prolific and renowned author, and his most recent book in English is Visconti, Insights into Flesh and Blood, which is published by Stanford. And there'll be a reference to Visconti this evening, I believe. And in German, Derrida and I, The Problem of Deconstruction. And Alex's next book, relevant to this evening's discussion, is Participation in Art and Politics, to be published by Circle. The format of this evening's lecture is that Alex will speak for around 40, 45 minutes, which will take us to roughly halfway through the evening. And then I have some questions for Alex that I'll invite him to respond to.
And that I don't know.
And then I must say, Alex sent me his paper in advance, so I've kind of prepared some questions, which I'll ask if Alex gives the same paper that he sent to me. And Alex, yeah, as Alex says, he hasn't seen my questions. And then if there's any time at all at the end, then I'll open it to the floor. So it's my great pleasure to welcome Alex.
Yes. Well, let me thank you, Jonathan, and the Forum for Philosophy for inviting me to speak here tonight, this evening. I need to say two things before I start reading the paper. The first thing is that, obviously, to talk about art and politics today, which is the overall topic of this series of lectures, means that one has, or at least it means in my eyes, that one has to choose an angle, a perspective, a guiding thread. And the angle, the perspective, or the guiding thread of this paper tonight will be the concept or the notion of the contemporary. So really, this is a paper about the contemporary in relation to art and politics, and this relationship will become most obvious, I suppose, towards the end of the paper. And the second thing I need to say is that I wrote this as a conversation between different voices, although these voices are not distinct enough for you to recognize each time when a new voice starts speaking. And this is why I have to find a way of conveying this to you, given that you can't read the paper as I'm reading it. And what I'll try to do, and what I've done before, because it's not the very first time I present this paper, but then I've only done it once or twice, is when a voice, I mean, I will be addressing one side of the audience and then the other side of the audience. As I said, the last time I gave this paper, it's a bit like a tennis match, and I'm watching it, as it were. So I look into this direction and then into that direction to indicate that a new voice starts speaking. And sometimes that takes a little while and sometimes it does not. But as I said, the voices are not very distinct. The idea is not that each voice represents a particular identifiable position. The paper is called For and Against the Contemporary, an Examination. And because it is a paper written in the form of a conversation, I can't really improvise, or it's much more difficult to improvise in this case. And I'm not going to speak as I sometimes do from notes, but I really have to read the paper. But I'll try to do it very slowly, so that the paper is as intelligible as possible. I remember. Hold it. You are getting off to a false start. How can you begin a paper on the contemporary, on art and politics today, with the words, I remember? You interrupt me. Does stubborn interruption belong to the condition of the contemporary? I remember Jacques Derrida. Are you trying to justify your presence here by appealing to the past, by stating your allegiance to a philosopher whose name still resonates in the present, though perhaps no longer in the same way as it once did. You forget that Derrida was your contemporary in the past, as it were, before you knew it and could measure up to him. For in his last conversation with a journalist, he anticipated what you are suggesting now. Back in 2004, only a few months before he died, he seemed convinced that his writings had not yet been read, as if he were waiting for contemporaries to come, or as if one's contemporaries could never be simply there, be contemporaneous with oneself, coincide with one's biological lifetime, or as if, in order to be a contemporary, one had to become a contemporary in the first place, make an impossible date by way of one's own uncertain achievements with future generations that might or might not keep this date. Derrida left a note for his son to read out at his funeral. It will not surprise you that in this note he greeted all those who had gathered to bid him farewell with a strange final address. I quote, "I love you and smile at you from wherever I might be." At the same time, and this is what you should remember, Derrida also believed that 2 weeks, or at most a month, after his death, nothing of his would be left. As if a belief in one's contemporaries, present or yet to come, were the symptom of an idealism designed to ward off the fact that an achievement must be radically disinterested, and that the expectation of a reward in the guise of some form of contemporaneity already harbors a distorting interest. In the face of this double feeling, I have not been read as yet, nothing will be left after I die of what I've written and said. In the face of this double feeling, as Derrida put it, death appears as the agent of the contemporary. It acts on behalf of the contemporary, makes it work as it undoes it, prevents it from ever doing any work. Now tell me, when you say that Derrida's name no longer resonates in the same way, are you opposing the contemporary to the outdated, to what pertains to a past that is not relevant to the present anymore? Or are you relying on a distinction between different ways of being contemporary, between contemporaries who are not contemporaries in the same manner, who have a different understanding of what it means and what it takes to be a contemporary? If, by definition, there must be at least 2 of us, but probably more, for us to be contemporaries, then there is a good chance of there also existing different ways of being contemporary. Let's assume that there are different ways of being contemporary, that being contemporary entails as much a difference as it entails a virtual unity between the way in which I am a contemporary and the way you are. I imagine then that one such way of being a contemporary will consist in rejecting any usage of the word that treats it as a synonym of those old-fashioned battle horses, the modern the new, even the avant-garde. Can the modern, the new, the avant-garde still belong to the vocabulary of the most contemporary of all contemporaries? A declared interest in the contemporary often amounts to a wordy invocation bereft of content, or a mere simulation of ideas. At the very tip, where the present fades into the past quickly, while the future remains unfathomable or proves all too predictable, we encounter a passion which tries to grasp imminence. It is happening, yes, so much so that it is not yet happening, contemporaries say. Or perhaps it is about to happen. No, it has happened already. The contemporary thus is the figure of an emptiness that is mad about itself, mad at itself, a mad or drunken opening that desperately craves emptiness, constantly falling prey to the commonplace, or producing a vague and incoherent discourse, constantly vomiting what it has just absorbed, or rejecting what it has almost assimilated. That's why the contemporary can be so depressing, so sad. A few weeks ago, I asked my friend Jean-Luc Nancy to send me an aphorism about the contemporary, and to do so in an email, a very contemporary form of communication, though I suspect that for those who Twitter or tweet, it is already so dated that they will have stopped listening by the time I finish this sentence. Here is what Jean-Luc wrote to me early the next morning, like someone who wishes to be contemporaneous with a day that is just beginning and share its uncertainty. I quote, "To be contemporary is to share the same time. When time is suspended, as is the case today, that is to say, when today ceases to be recognizable, one shares the uncertainty, the suspense. One exists in shared suspension. But one way or the other, one escapes from the flux of time. It is a form of eternity." End of quote. What if the contemporary were a Janus-faced figure? A figure with two faces. When it turns one of its two faces toward us, it appears as a figure of emptiness, secluded from time, endlessly or eternally circling inside the abyss into which the tip of the present collapses again and again, caught in an empty time that only mirrors eternity, sharing nothing except for an insatiable hunger fed by the revulsion that the passing of time inspires. At the end of Conversation Piece, a film Luchino Visconti made late in his life, in Italian the film is called differently, it's called Gruppo di Famiglia in un Interno. At the end of Conversation Piece, a film Luchino Visconti made late in his life, one character says about her former lover, a dead young man who may have committed suicide, that he had not had time, that he had not given himself time enough to be taught the lesson of life. supposedly what one learns if one's lifetime is not cut short, if one does not put an end to it prematurely, is that the living forget the dead. No matter how burning the memory may have been that once kept their trace. Perhaps there is a way of being contemporary that tries to avoid this lesson by abandoning itself so hopelessly to emptiness that emptiness turns into a passion, as you claim. So, would the best way of being contemporary, of existing as a contemporary, consist in taking one's eyes off anything that self-consciously presents itself as contemporary? In a preface added to the first edition of a novel that the Majorcan writer Llorenç Villalonga published in 1963, it's called in Catalan Desenllaç amb Llo, I have found an allusion to original minds at the margins of passing fashions. These minds are said to be neither antiquated when they look back, nor precursory when they overturn other minds. Obviously, the fact that, at one point, someone's ideas were contemporaneous with someone else's and influenced them does not mean that they remained influential and continue to determine contemporary thought. But assuming we can agree on what counts as such thought and what does not, is it enough to state that these ideas do not determine contemporary thought anymore in order to assert that they have lost their force and must be dismissed as meaningless to an understanding of the present? The fate of contemporary thought, eager to advertise itself as contemporary, and of contemporary art, keen on being seen, is that they must keep changing horses in midstream. Just don't remind the thinker or the artist of their fate. They won't like it. Allow me to intervene. I wish to make a related point by asking whether sharing a room or a space with others, being there at the same time as they are, simultaneously, is enough to say that they are one's contemporaries. If the contemporary is not just an indifferent concept, or a concept used indifferently to designate any possible juxtaposition of existences in the present time, if the contemporary, the concept of the contemporary, is a value and not a fact, then surely it must involve some selection, some filtering, some choice, some elective affinity. It requires an eye capable of seeing differences. You have drawn our attention to the difference between ways of being contemporary. Since there are always many contemporaries, two at least, it is always possible and even likely that there will be differences between ways of being contemporary. But if we now turn our attention to what accounts for the unity of the contemporary and allows a group of people existing in the same world at the same time to be identified as contemporaries, we find that once again we must resort to difference. From this perspective, I cannot be a contemporary without distinguishing myself from others who are presently alive or who are more or less my age. Not all attempts at distinguishing myself can be equally valuable or valid. Also, what deserves to be called contemporary must be identified on a basis that abstract temporal and spatial simultaneity does not provide. It is inclusive only to the extent that it is exclusive, and that it is exclusive twice over, once with regard to things past, and again with regards to things present. This is why the contemporary, so slippery and hard to pin down, is always at risk of solidifying into the most dogmatic and rigid of notions, a notion employed to inhibit and intimidate, sometimes even to bully the other. I have met a person who, each time she vindicates an interest in the contemporary, conceives of it in terms of a moment in an ongoing relay race. This is the moment when a handing over takes place that is also meant to be a sort of transformation. By changing hands, the baton, the object, mutates into something contemporary. We no longer speak of X, we speak of Y now, she says. For example, she says sometimes we no longer speak of critique or criticism, we speak of criticality now. And I'm never quite sure whether she's reporting from the front, making it up as she goes along, or imposing words that stand in for thoughts. Walter Benjamin, a critic of the homogeneous and empty time of progress, sought a temporal force in the past that would hit the present as if it were coming from the future, even though many of his contemporaries seemed oblivious to the existence of such a force. He conceived of it as the intense experience of a time full of presentness, of a past filled with actuality, and called it Jetztzeit, now time. Only now time opens an access to the future from which the present is forever separated, for only the past can preserve the future's revolutionary otherness. That the present is the site where an instinct must prove itself and sense the undercurrent of now time in the past, that it, the present, serves merely as a springboard to leap into a now time detected instinctively, a now time in the past, that it is in the past that the present has to start looking for itself, for the actual or the contemporary, if it ever wants to encounter the future, means that nothing happens in the present, that the present is essentially an empty time. Doubtless, now time is as devoid of content as the present. Yet what distinguishes it, now time, from the present, is not a content, but an intensity that the present lacks. In now time, content has turned into intensity, cannot be separated from it, into an intensity that imparts itself as an urgency. Now time is tense, time as tension, while the present is flat, time as emptiness. Perhaps now time is eternity at the tip of the present, the other face of the Janus-faced figure of the contemporary, an intensity that escapes the flux of time, the point at which the past communicates with the future, and where the present is left behind in a sudden, instinctive leap. Benjamin compares this leap to the leap of a tiger. In his animal sketching, Alexander Calder notes that, I quote, "animals think with their bodies to a greater extent than man does," end of quote. Perhaps the thinking of the present is a bodily awareness that captures the past. We don't see it coming because it has come already. It has happened. Does it then not follow from Benjamin's argument that there is an illusion which belongs to the present? The illusion or the fiction of the contemporary would consist in the belief that the future begins right now in the present, and that the task of the living, of the ones who live now but not in now time, would be to concern themselves with the present as the time that bears the future, as the time in which the future is given or about to be given. But why would that be so exactly? Benjamin claims that past generations have made what he calls a secret appointment with future generations, with us. By making such a claim, he on the one hand confirms the impossibility of knowing the contemporary, of knowing what it could mean to speak of oneself and others as contemporaries. That will only reveal itself perhaps in the future, but never in the present. So by making such a claim, Benjamin on the one hand confirms the impossibility of knowing the contemporary, of knowing what it could mean to speak of oneself and others as contemporaries, while on the other hand, he hints at the essential secrecy or hiddenness of work undertaken in the present. Just as Derrida does in his last interview, "No one has read me yet." Or as Nietzsche too, in his untimely meditation on Richard Wagner, in a meditation directed against the times for the sake of future times. Work undertaken in the present cannot but remain hidden, hidden to itself, precisely because it is being undertaken as we speak. To see the work undertaken in the present, as we speak, to see whether actually any work is being undertaken right now, something we cannot know in advance, we need to distance ourselves from the present, leap into the past, into now time, and return to the present as revolutionaries. From the future that this leap into the past, may disclose to us. In a nutshell, you take Benjamin to imply that contemporaries can never live a life that would be contemporaneous with itself, as it were, and that there is an anachronism that splits the contemporary. However, Nietzsche also reminds us in his untimely meditations, from which you quoted a moment ago, that interpretations of the past depend on the highest powers of the present, on the most vigorous of all contemporary efforts. And that only the one who knows about the present, and thus proves to be an architect of the future, is able to listen to the oracle, as Nietzsche says, of the past. Let's not forget that Benjamin himself invokes a special sense to attain now time, an instinct without which the leap into the past can never succeed, and that he regards this sense or this flair, Witterung in German, to be active in fashion. Anna Wintour says that she will quit Vogue when the anger becomes too much for her. My contemporaries are the ones who can make me angry. When I asked Min Hogg how one avoids confusion at a fashion show, she replied, "You must pick three or four dresses that catch your eye and then build your article around these dresses." I remember Jacques Derrida telling me, in a private conversation, how irritated he felt when working on a text he had been commissioned to write for a series called The Contemporaries. Was the request not already a distinction? While you were all talking at the same time, interrupting each other, asking so many questions and going off into so many directions that I got confused, I looked up Derrida's text and found the following phrase, I quote, "One writes only at the moment when one gives the contemporary the slip," end of quote. One writes only at the moment when one gives the contemporary the slip. In French, Derrida uses the expression fausse compagnie, which, if we translate it literally, not idiomatically it would be to give the slip, means to twist or distort company, fausse compagnie, to twist or distort company, to break a promise, if you wish. Is making a promise not always a form of keeping others company and of keeping company with others? Whoever wants to undertake some work, to achieve something, to do some writing, for example, must betray his so-called contemporaries. Derrida seems to tell us. The contemporaries to whom one is not really committed, since the time one shares with them is shared only in the abstract. Time cannot be shared otherwise unless one distances oneself from the presence of the contemporaries and follows the trace of writing. You know that for Derrida, writing is also and primarily a synonym for experience. Just as writing separates us from the present, experience, the endurance of otherness, begins where presence exposes itself to absence and the present is interrupted. So the one who betrays his contemporaries, who refuses to include himself within the alleged unity of a temporal presence, follows the trace of writing, all the more so as, in the case with which Derrida is concerned here, he devotes himself to the very activity of writing and thereby allows himself to experience something, time, for instance. What emerges at this point is that the hiddenness of work in the present is not simply due to the fact that we are too close to see it, or that, in a sense, it is too contemporary to be truly contemporary, but rather that it, work undertaken in the present, results from the displacing and disrupting effect that any experience must have, any experience that reveals itself to be at the origin of, say, a work of art, or that lies in the work's creation, or that is even the experience which the work itself enables. Adorno, in his Negative Dialectics, notes that thoughtful people and artists have often registered a feeling of coldness and distance, of not being quite present, and of not joining in the game, as if, I quote, they were not entirely themselves, but a kind of spectator, end of quote. He then asks whether it is not this aspect of human life that constitutes its immortal part, whether a detached comportment does not show itself to be more humane than different forms of involvement that deny the inanity of existence, at least under specific historical conditions. Such thoughts remind me of two conversations in Thomas Mann's novel Lotte in Weimar. In this novel, the protagonist visits Weimar as an old woman. She wishes to see Goethe again, for there was a time when the poet was infatuated with her and used her as one of his real-life models in his writing. After her arrival, Dr. Riemer, a philologist who belongs to Goethe's entourage, pays a courtesy call on Lotte. In the course of the long conversation that ensues, Riemer describes the great artist's character and sees his art as the result of both absolute love and absolute annihilation or indifference. He also mentions a coldness entirely peculiar to absolute art, a destructive equanimity. Lotte later recognizes that, as the young Goethe wooed her, she and her husband could not avoid having a secret inkling. They felt that, no matter how much suffering the poet's passion would cause, it was perhaps merely a sort of game, something on which one could not rely, since it served ends situated outside of the human sphere. The novel comes to a close with a ghostly conversation between the old Lotte and the old Goethe that takes place in the darkness of a carriage. Here, a Goethe who may not be actually present, appearing only as an interlocutor in Lotte's inner monologue or dialogue, justifies his behavior by referring to the cosmic force of metamorphosis, to a play of transformations that he takes to be the fate of human existence. Pascal stresses the coldness of the Gospels, a coldness that he attributes to the disinterestedness with which they were written, the lack of affectation and resentment. Yet he also remarks that we never stick to the present and that therefore we do not live. We hide the present because it is a source of grievance, or because, when it causes us pleasure, it still fades away. I see, but Derrida does not simply write that one gives the contemporary the slip when one writes. Rather, by writing that one writes only at the moment when one gives the contemporary the slip, he acknowledges that one can be deluded about writing and assume that one is writing when in truth one is not. This is the moment when one truly betrays the other, breaks one's promise, and ceases to keep him company, not because one turns away from him, but because one turns toward him, as if the contemporary were a given. In the beginning, I interrupted you, and you wondered whether stubborn interruption does not belong to the condition of the contemporary. I can hear the uninterrupted ringing of a phone. In the film conversation piece, it resonates unnervingly in the professor's flat after it has been invaded by various members of the most vulgar of families, each one of which is a specimen of a certain type of contemporary behavior in the mid-70s. Let me channel the brutality or the violence of an interruption into a series of theses designed to interrupt the interruption of art and thought that seems to define an important dimension of contemporary culture today. I will leave it to you to accept or dismiss these theses, to relate to them as convincing intuitions or as naive, perhaps even offensive, impositions. My theses are meant to illustrate the delusion to which you have just referred when clarifying further the point Derrida makes in relation to the contemporary, the fact that one can delude oneself when one thinks one is writing. These theses are meant to specify the source of the sadness that befalls me each time the contemporary shows its empty face. My first thesis states that in the past 20 years or so, the most pervasive and consistent usage of the adjective contemporary in the cultural realm has connected it with the noun art, contemporary art, and that the extraordinary attention devoted to contemporary art has been, on the level of the infrastructure, the predictable outcome of an accumulation of profits, and on the level of the superstructure, the consequence of an impoverishment in conceptual imagination equal only to the poverty of much of the production itself. Contemporary art has shaped the emperor's and the empress's new clothes, whether the royalties were artists, curators, or academics driven by theory. My second thesis states that the world of contemporary art, and especially of the jargon that gives credentials to its installations, and that in the past decade has given prominence to archives, potentialities, participations, and binaries, is a world of make-believe in which networking and lobbying, naivety and slyness, pseudo-activity and drivel prevail, with the aim only of protecting the machine against an interruption of its functioning, and of ensuring the survival of those who keep boosting the business. Contemporary works of art are frequently said to be thought-provoking, but the thoughts they allegedly provoke are rarely put into words and discussed, and never really lead to thinking differently. Also, contemporary works of art constantly seem to raise questions of great relevance, but these questions tend to be of such a general nature when the critics make them explicit that they can hardly expect ever to meet with interesting answers. Contemporary works of art are regularly credited with exploring themes of this and that, of community and access. But the findings of these explorations are mostly rather predictable and, never mind the excitement, fit perfectly into conventional patterns. Is it not telling that such works so often elicit the most tired and tiresome thematic criticism? My third thesis states that an important element of the superstructure or the ideology of the world of contemporary art, one that accounts for some of its attractiveness in the eyes of many, is the semblance of radicalism brought about by the integration of politics into the machine, but only after an infantilization and trivialization has rendered politics or the political harmless and evacuated any serious critical impulse from it. Here, politics resembles the toys with which, in the third generation, Fassbinder's funny send-up of the German autumn, a group of bourgeois Berlin ninnies, whose clownish terrorism serves the causes of capitalism, plays at the game of revolution. When the traitor in the group proposes to blow up the town hall of Schöneberg, a city district, the neurotic wife of a bank manager who has joined the group exclaims with childish delight, "That's genius! I want to do it! Please let me do it alone!" Can you provide an example for your thesis? If you're willing to be patient, I suggest that we read and analyze. Sorry, it's going to take another 10 minutes. It's a bit longer than I had expected. Is that all right? All right. Thank you. If you are willing to be patient, I suggest that we read and analyze a few sentences in Art as Social Interstice. One, is that, I never know how to pronounce that word.
Interstice.
Interstice. Thank you, Jonathan. Art as Social Interstice, one of the opening sections of Relational Aesthetics, a book which, from my perspective, has made a great impact on recent contemporary art and has continued to inform, implicitly or explicitly, knowingly or unknowingly, the ways in which such art is often discussed. After having announced in the previous section that the idealistic and teleological version of modernity is dead, one of those commonplaces, and after having observed that art can be considered a place that, this is of course the author, not me, a place that produces a specific sociability, Nicolas Bourriaud, the author of this book, unexpectedly picks up a concept to be found in Marx. Interstice translates metacosmion or intermundium, a concept Marx borrows from Epicurus in Das Kapital, to designate not so much a gap in which the gods are said to live a blissful life undisturbed by mundane matters and devoid of all influence upon them, but a gap in which the nations of antiquity went about their trading before becoming producers of commodities, relating to these commodities as values and treating their own individual labor as homogeneous human labor. Bourriaud wishes to demonstrate that art, inasmuch as it is relational and fulfills a complementary function, generates, I quote, forms of conviviality capable of relaunching the modern emancipation plan, that one that at the same time is dead, and that such conviviality emerges in the interstices of capitalism. He writes, I quote, "Over and above its mercantile nature and its semantic value, the work of art represents a social interstice. This interstice term was used by Karl Marx to describe trading communities that elude the capitalist economic context by being removed from the law of profit, barter, merchandising, autarkic types of production, etc. The interstice is a place in human relations which fits more or less harmoniously and openly into the overall system, but suggests other trading possibilities than those in effect within the system. This is the precise nature of the contemporary art exhibition in the arena of representational commerce. It creates free areas and time spans whose rhythm contrasts with those structuring everyday life, and it encourages an interhuman commerce that differs from the communication zones that are imposed upon us. End of quote. The political emphasis that characterizes this short passage, if only because Marx is named, and because it alludes to an imposition resisted, yeah, the communication zones that are imposed upon us, this political emphasis is deflated by the depoliticizing effect of its actual content. After all, the interstices or intermundia of the ancient world of which Marx speaks are transferred here into capitalism, where the freedom for which they allow is meant to unfold untouched, despite its immediate vicinity to power and domination, to antagonism and class struggle, to imposed communication zones. To be sure, Marx also conceives of the existence of Jews in the pores of Polish society as analogous to the existence of real trading nations in the interstices or intermundia of antiquity. Yet one wonders what example he would have given Marx if he had revised Das Kapital after the end of the Second World War. When measured against the depoliticization triggered by Bourriaud's attribution of harmony and openness to human relations that are said to form in the interstices of contemporary art exhibitions, the political invocation of a modern emancipation plan, which still resonates there where he, Bourriaud, distinguishes between free and imposed communication, this invocation of a modern emancipation plan appears to be utterly vacuous. If there is a question Bourriaud does not ask, and that his usage of the notion of an interstice is intended to suppress, then it must be the question of the immunity granted to contemporary art exhibitions. His uncritical celebration of representational commerce in current capitalism undermines the affirmative reference to Marx, revealing to the attentive reader, to the reader who is not entranced by catchwords, the shallowness of Bourriaud's identification with the victims, with those upon whom communication zones have been imposed, whatever that may mean. The interhuman commerce which art exhibitions are said to encourage turns out to be just as reified or commodified or corrupted as the representational commerce itself, for it is arbitrarily posited, imposed in the same manner as the repressive communication zones. By relating to the contemporary as something given, Bourriaud depoliticizes art's political ambitions, or uncovers against his will the depoliticization at work in contemporary art. Sorry, that was a bit long. Yet naturally, all of this ends up being somewhat consoling, for out of the negativity, quite another message emerges, that such a zone of freedom and free critique can be maintained by the instrumental system of capitalism. That's from Julian Stalabres's very short introduction to contemporary art. It is time to examine whether we have made any headway. The contemporary seems to be a rare animal that can rotate on its own neck and exhibit different faces, depending on whether we think of it as a given or an uncertain achievement, as an empty, abstract, deceptive present, or a springboard into the past and the untimeliness of creation. But if the contemporary is indeed Janus-faced, even the sadness of an encounter with its emptiness, with the semblance of radicalism, must still relate to the excitement of leaping into now time or starting to write. Is the present not necessarily empty and therefore always a cause for sadness, also in the case when, in acquiring the sense or developing the instinct that is required to venture in the past's now time, we begin to depart from it? In one of his last letters to a young poet, dating from 1904, Rilke distinguishes between two forms of sadness, or rather between two ways of being sad, low-spirited. Sadness that we are unable to bear and that we carry around in a manner reminiscent of the contemporary that publicizes itself, recoils and becomes, I quote, unlived, spurned, lost life, of which we may die, end of quote. However, if it were possible for us to see further than our knowledge reaches, then, Rilke says, we would gain an awareness of sadness as a moment, I quote, when something new has entered into us, something unknown, end of quote. Our task would then consist in transforming the future. To the extent that the future releases itself and makes us sad before it actually occurs, it gives us the impression that we have nothing left except for the present, for a deadly life that must remain unlived. This is the impression we need to withstand and transform the future into our destiny, into a future that will no longer merely happen to us, occur externally, but that will step out of us to others, rather than merely occurring to us externally. Could we ever hope to leap into now time, into the past, had the new not entered our lives already, unrecognizable to knowledge? Although Giorgio Agamben does not quote Rilke in his essay What is the Contemporary, it may not be too far-fetched to understand his answer to the question in this sense. The life of the contemporary, he claims, lies in an attentiveness to the unlived, to, I quote, a present where we have never been, whether on account of a forbidding closeness or it's the present's traumatic import. No wonder Rilke is addressing his letter to a young poet. It is the sign of youth that it cannot draw on any of the concepts and slogans that circulate in the present if it wants to refer to itself, and that it can trust only its own polemical and critical powers, its own increased feeling of life. This is Nietzsche's idea of youth at the end of his untimely meditation on history. It suggests that the young are more contemporary than those who live in the present. But that's not what I had in mind. For it is still Rilke, not quite 30 years old when he writes his letter, and nonetheless not a young poet anymore, who sends a young poet his thoughts about sadness, about the two kinds of sadness. The moment when the future, which has not come yet, is transformed so that it can no longer come from elsewhere, as it were, not simply, remember what Rilke says, it will step out of us to another, to others. This moment is the moment of the contemporary, the moment when the future, which has not come yet, is transformed so that it can no longer come from elsewhere, as it were, not simply. Is the moment of the contemporary, the moment of metamorphosis, of youth, of a force or an intensity that cannot be opposed to maturity and old age, to petrification and senility, because such youth names the point at which youth turns into maturity, maturity into youth, the point at which youth, maturity, and old age touch and prove indistinguishable. I get it. We must choose between the contemporary that remains subjected to change and falls prey to the passion of emptiness, and the contemporary that penetrates into the very heart of metamorphosis. But how do I foster a sense for now time? How do I begin to write? Do you remember? Well, give it the slip. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for that, Alex. We have 25 minutes now by way of response and counter response. I want to begin with one of your criticisms of.
Do you have something for me to write?
I want to begin with. Can I have some more water?
Thank you.
With one of your criticisms of contemporary art, that for the most part it's vacuous, lacking in criticality.
No, lots of criticality.
All right, lacking in critique, maybe. And that it's as commercialized as that which you would otherwise resist. And I want to approach this criticism through Derrida, the memory of whom begins your paper. In one of his late texts, Voyou of 2002, translated, published in English as Rogues, Derrida says the following, and I quote, "Democracy is the only system, the only constitutional paradigm in which, in principle, one has or assumes the right to criticize everything publicly, including the idea of democracy, its concept, its history, and its name, including the idea of the constitutional paradigm and the absolute authority of the law. It is thus the only paradigm that is universalizable, whence its chance and its fragility." End of quote. And in an earlier text, an interview dating from 1989, published as This Strange Institution Called Literature, Derrida describes literature as, I quote, "a space in which everything can be said, to the extent that literature can defy or lift the law." And he links this strange institution called literature to democracy, to, and I quote, "the coming about of the modern idea of democracy. It is," he says, "inseparable from what calls forth a democracy in the most open and doubtless itself to come sense of democracy." So, end of quote. So we have democracy as the space in which everything can be said, including defiance of the law, and literature as the space in which everything can be said, to the extent that it can also defy the law. And the can, that everything can be said in these two realms, is not just an option available to it, but there's a necessity. Mm-hmm. To the extent that literature must ask, what is literature? It addresses everything. It brings in everything that can be said into its realm. And it would appear that the two for Derrida, democracy and literature, are co-original with each other in this respect. Now, if we go along with the idea that the institution of literature as a space in which anything can be said is what leads to the autonomy of the aesthetic realm, a space in which anything and everything can count as art.
That's not the same.
Well, no, it's not the same, yeah, but if it leads to something like that, yeah, where the autonomy of that realm is heteronomously constituted by the fact that it can include everything,
mm-hmm,
then would it be valid to raise the question or the objection to your criticism of contemporary art that it's vacuous and it says everything and nothing, that it has to say everything and nothing, that art has to say everything and nothing. That contemporary art must do this in order to become its opposite. In the sense that if art is to be critical, then it must say everything. This would be what Derrida calls in the citation I've just read, it's chance and fragility. And in elsewhere in Rogues, he calls it the double bind of threat and chance. That if there is such a thing as literature to come, democracy to come, it brings with it not just the possibility of the transformation for the better, but the threat of the worst. In other words, the nothing that goes along with the everything, everything and nothing.
Okay, I replace it away.
Sure.
Good. Yes, thank you. No, the answer is no. My answer is no. Well, first of all, I should say that I think this is should be obvious, but maybe it's not. That, of course, what you know, my critical remarks about, or the critical remarks in the paper about contemporary art are not meant to encompass all of contemporary art, but a certain understanding of contemporary art, in as much as it has become, as some would say, hegemonical or prevailing or has dominated the so-called cultural realm in the past 20 years or so.
But wasn't your analysis quite classical rather than contemporary?
Sorry?
I mean, wasn't your analysis very classical in nature, and yet you're trying to attempt to describe the contemporary? I mean, surely your analysis should be self-similar and therefore equally transgressive, absenting, empty. You know what I mean?
Well, I think my analysis should be either right or wrong, and I think it's right.
Shouldn't it be both things?
How transgressive it is, I would leave to you to judge. The fact that someone presents itself in classical terms, does that mean already that it's not transgressive?
It does, yes, but where is that awareness? I mean,
look, I would claim for my analysis that it's right, you can prove that it's wrong. I would also claim that it is transgressive in a way perhaps less apparent than it seems to be. But before we go before we go down that road, maybe I should try to answer Jonathan's question, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure.
we're going to open it up. That's the idea. Of course, we have to be brief for that. I'm not even quite sure that I understand. Having said what I just said about contemporary art, as it were, and you know what exactly it is that I mean by that, and what I try to analyze here, in one way or the other. You say, but art has to be able, following Derrida, to say everything and nothing. Maybe, yes. I would not necessarily contest that. But my point here is that a certain type of art, which is identified often as contemporary art, and to which there's a certain unity, despite the disparities, does not say anything. It's not that it says everything and nothing. It's that it does not say anything, as it were. Yes, that's my point here. That it presents itself as if it were saying something, as if it were saying everything and nothing, perhaps, by, for example, asking questions about the limits between art and non-art, about the institutional frameworks that make art into art, and so on and so forth. I mean, you all know this type of questions. It's not exactly new. So it's an art that, in a sense, simulates this kind of radicality. It says everything and nothing, and yet it does not say anything. Yes, that was my contention, really. So what I'm denouncing here, as it were, is a simulation or a make-believe, a way of make-believe, yes? So I would go along with your definition, and then the question would become, with that definition that which you take from Derrida, and say what I've just said, and then say, that art can say everything and nothing, That is something particular about the domain of art or literature, as it is about democracy, and that it means that it has to constantly, perhaps even question itself, still requires that one distinguishes between works of art which do that, even if they do not call themselves works of art anymore, or if it becomes difficult to call them works of art, and works of art, whether they call themselves works of art or not, which only pretend to do that, but are not really doing that. And it's that that I'm targeting here.
Okay, but my point is that art has to say nothing, or has to not say anything in order that it say something, if it's to be art. But that,
yes,
whether that...
Fine, but then I would say this kind of contemporary art that I'm targeting, while not saying anything, never stops talking.
Mm-hmm.
Never stops telling you what you are meant to think about it, what you are meant to do with
okay.
it, what it is doing.
But then,
because it exists only in the realm of this kind of prefabricated discourse.
Okay. Two questions then. In order for us to adjudicate that art, which may in fact say something, doesn't that art have to not be contemporaneous with itself in order for us to be able to see that it says something? It can't see that itself, is it? It can't be contemporaneous with itself.
Yes, that's why I say that this is the kind of being contemporary which advertises itself as contemporary,
right.
as if it could see itself.
Right.
It's not the one that acknowledges what I've called here the hiddenness or the secrecy of work undertaken in the present.
Right.
On the contrary, it's one that constantly wants to exploit the present as a resource for itself that allows it to advertise itself as this kind of sexy thing,
okay.
contemporary art.
Then the question for me becomes, and it's the question one of you asks yourself in the paper, will give me an example. And in response
mm-hmm.
to that question,
yes.
the example you give is a theory.
Yes.
You give the theory of relational
yes.
aesthetics.
Yes.
But can you give an example of an artwork that would escape that, which is not contemporaneous with itself, but which is contemporary art, and which does say something?
Yes, I could, but I don't see the point of doing it. I mean, I can, not because I don't, I can do that, I can give you
but
names,
then you,
and I have, and I've, and I write about contemporary artists, as it were.
Right, so the example would then need to show that it's not contemporary
yes.
with, it,
yes.
with itself.
Yes, but, you know, I mean, how do you want me to do that now?
Well, okay, just an acknowledgement then, that the criticism...
That's
why
I say it's not about all
of
contemporary
it's kind of but it's a generalization.
I'm saying it's a generalization. I'm saying that within... contemporary art, speaking of contemporary art in a very broad sense, there is something which gets identified more specifically as contemporary art in as much as it advertises itself constantly as contemporary art. Yes, it is this type of art which I think betrays a certain unity to it, even if it's, you know, different examples will be different examples. And that's what I'm targeting and analyzing here.
Mm-hmm.
That's what this is all about, as
mm-hmm.
it were, the critical or polemical part of the presentation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I said, this does not mean, of course, that every single artist working today falls into that category, just as it does not mean that every single philosopher or whatever working today is one of these people who adopt this jargon and basically spend their time talking about archives and potentialities and so on and so forth as concepts which belong to a jargon,
mm-hmm.
yes, because these concepts of course have a different function elsewhere as well, but as concepts which belong to a jargon.
Mm-hmm.
It's the kind of situation where someone says that and people go like, oh yes, you know, because it's simply a kind of catchword, the trigger, it's like a kind of, it's a light, you know, when it's green you can go.
Okay,
so, you know, they open the doors by saying that and you feel you are kind of part of something. It's all rather vague and all rather warm,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you belong. And that's what it's all about, to
okay.
show that you belong and that they belong too.
But there is the possible inference that the examples that you do give in your paper, in their not being examples of contemporary art,
right.
are more contemporary for their not being contemporary art.
Yes, this is a deliberate
real
strategy to use examples which seem like, oh my God, Visconti,
mm-hmm.
or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or, oh my God, Goethe and Thomas Mann.
A question about the form of your paper, the dialogue form or the conversation form. To be contemporary means to become contemporary.
Yeah.
Or in other words, the contemporary is not coextensive with the present.
It's not a given.
Right, and that in order to become contemporary, one must be disinterested in the present, to a certain
yeah.
extent. And that if you
but
believe...
at the same time, there must be a high awareness of what is going on in the present.
Okay,
yes.
Okay. Now
this interested means not transforming the present into something which you use as a tag
right.
to advertise what you're doing.
Okay, well then the question then I want to ask is about the presentness or the presence unto themselves of the at least two voices of your paper.
Yeah.
So in what way, if any, is the dialogue or the conversational form
yeah.
of your paper, its Janus faceness, its rotating on its own neck, which you yourself would demonstrate, to what extent is this performative of the problem of which it speaks? The form is performative of the problem of which it speaks. In order that there be a conversation, two interlocutors must be present to each other. But you've already cast doubt on that possibility, that we can't just claim for ourselves a presence to each other. But the form of your paper is as if the two were involved in a dialogue.
Yeah.
So to what extent are they involved in a dialogue in contemporaneous with each other rather than in the present, through its form, through the form? How does your paper achieve that through its form?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, maybe I should say two things then. First thing is, in a way it's a rather artificial form, which allows me to say lots of things, as you noticed. Quote many different people who have or do not have much in common, and tackle the question from different angles and perspectives again and again, although perhaps a certain thread guides me through the paper as well, or guides the different voices through the paper. So it's a kind of artifice that allows me to do that. I feel that when writing about a topic like this, it is very difficult to really keep with a more traditional, classical form in which one develops an argument, starts with this, ends up with that. Yes. So it provides a certain openness. At the same time, these are weak voices in the sense that they are not strongly identified with one position or another. They are not constantly discussed. I mean, there's not argument, counter-argument, argument, counter-argument, and so on and so forth. It's, as it were, opening up different perspectives, as it were, and allow different points to be made without being preoccupied from the beginning of how to integrate all these points into an overall coherent discourse about the contemporary. The second point is, but is this not what you, let me answer you with a question. There's more to what you were saying, of course, to the point. Is this not what we do in a conversation? We don't know in advance, not always at least, whom we are talking to, with whom we are talking, and what will happen. Yes, we don't know that. I mean, for instance, right now, although I've known you for a while, and at the same time, for a long time, I have not had many conversations with you. And many of you I don't know at all. When one engages in this kind of conversation, who knows what you are going to say if you say something at all? One doesn't really know what's going to happen, or only to some extent, yes? And why is this important or relevant? Well, precisely because one thing I think that you find out in a conversation ultimately is whether the other one is someone you want to talk to or not. And whether you measure up to the other, are able to measure up to what the other one is saying or not. And that's how you start selecting people to whom you talk and people to whom you don't talk. That is, if I want to talk about this because this is something that is important to me, then I will say, I will try to talk to people who I believe will take what I may want to say seriously, will devote it some time and attention, will think it's worth their time listening to it. And at the same time, people who I will take seriously, because I think that what they will say, they will say having thought about it, it will be thoughtful.
Mm.
And I will not talk to people who I think are idiots, or who I think, have no idea, or ultimately are people who are very nice, but for maybe not. But they're too biased or prejudiced, or they're not able to, I don't think this is just me, that's what we all do, as it were. And this is how a conversation comes about or does not come about, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
with at the same time, a conversation is something which, you know, allows for constant should allow to some extent for constant interruptions, possibly without the other one immediately getting angry, and so on and so forth. So there's all of that going on there.
And is there also going on there this kind of necessary betrayal of giving the contemporary the slip, as it were? So one of the voices must necessarily give the other the slip in order that it writes in the way that
Yes, I mean, if I want, if yes, absolutely, yes, in the sense that, you know, I think that the person I will take seriously, or whose possible contributions or thoughts I will value, is going to be the person whom I know is not interested primarily, as it were, in what exactly, in being seen as saying this or that. Yes, in being seen as being contemporary, cutting edge, or something else, in being seen as being terribly scholarly, learned, I mean, all of it doesn't matter, yes? The person who doesn't, you know, see. So in that sense, if to give the slip to the contemporary means to, as it were, no longer worry that much about being seen as part of, belonging to, the present, to the people who are around. I'm one of you too. I have my role but to play here. I have my thing to say here in this space which already exists, you know. If that's what it means, then yes, of course, I will value people whose primary interest is not that.
Right, but then
no,
that has implications.
People who do that.
Sorry for interrupting, but that has implications.
Because I think they will be more thoughtful. There will be people who will be less, as it were, will be more disinterested in their approach. They will be, in other words, more interested in the argument or the thought itself,
right,
beyond, as it were, other considerations.
Right, well then, that beyond has implications for political dialogue or political conversation.
Yes.
That disinterestedness with respect to the present,
yes,
would somehow imply that it cannot be political in the sense that it addresses politics of the present.
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say because, you know, this is the other side of it. All of this requires, at the same time, of course, a high awareness, you know, a flair, as Benjamin says. To leap into the past, which is Benjamin's way of addressing this question, perhaps, means to have a flair, to be able, that's why, you know, there's a link with fashion there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's maybe, as it were, not being interested in the present in the sense of not transforming the present into something one can, not transforming one's interest into something one can exhibit as such, advertise as such, means precisely, you know, allowing oneself to gain a certain flair for what is really at stake in the present, yes?
Mm-hmm.
And that will allow you then to leap into the past or elsewhere, if you wish, and to make connections which are interesting because they are revealing, and which you think about. It's like this. I mean, this sounds very abstract, but it's not at all. It's like when someone talks about the present and gives you the kind of commonplaces which you know already. Yes, like there was one commonplace here, you know, the end of modernity, the end of the teleological discourse, and blah 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 blah. I mean, sociologists among you will know this by heart. You know, that's one of the many commonplaces. And there are so many. It's like, you know, depending on which paper you have just read, or on which news channel you have just exploited, or, you know, whose friends you are, who have special access to, and have you told you that. It's like, you know, people talking about politics, and it's like they are talking about cars or computers, and, you know, but in truth, you have no idea what is really going on. It's not about that at all. It's about something else. And all they are revealing and saying that is that, you know, they have some source which others don't have. All of that is not that very interesting, although it's a favorite sport. And if you don't participate in that, you are often seen as being kind of hopeless. Much more interesting is someone who is really able to say something revealing about politics now and about the present by making an unexpected connection, you see? And I'm interested in what allows for that.
A question about, we don't have much time, a couple of minutes.
But we want to open it, because, I mean, I'm
well, I want to ask a question.
I have time,
Visconti.
I mean, I don't have to go at 8,
Phil.
So if you want to stay for another 5 minutes.
We have to, can I just quickly ask a question about the Visconti film, Alex?
Yeah, but
what?
We can talk about the discontent room afterwards. It's 8 o'clock. We have to know.
Well, we have to get up.
Yeah. No, we let someone ask a question. Sorry.
We have to get up. If I can't ask a question, we'll leave.
Okay, I leave it to you. You are the chair. You're the chair. You are the chair. It's a suggestion. You are the chair.
So if we have to leave by 8, then we should leave now.
Yeah. I'm happy to stay.
Me too. I would love to stay.
One question. Come on.
No, we don't have the time.
Yeah,
I do apologize for speaking for too long.
Do we have to get out of here?
I don't think you can have a public meeting.
No, outside this door.
What about a pub?
Can't we carry on for a few minutes?
Exactly.
Okay. Yes, ask a question, quick.
We
have to leave.
I enjoy your sentiments about contemporary art or something. The artist is the child of their times, but woe to them if they are the disciple of their times, and even more so if they are the favourite of their times. Now, we live in a very partisan culture. Some people say that 30 years of this government, etc. Art, the art that's getting chosen by our curators and so forth, is art that reflects their own beliefs and their own experience, and reflects this Cartesian culture with its binary thinking, its simplistic dualisms of body and mind, spirits and reason, practice and thought. So we have. It doesn't seem to me incredible that we have the kind of crisis or malaise in contemporary art fashions that we have now.
Could you ask a question, given that you are all of this extraordinary privilege?
I was wondering what your response might be to Schiller's. Schiller was there a long time before us, and he put it rather well, as he did many other things. Would you feel that, leaping into his past will bring us up to our...
Well, Schiller I can't really go into the question, but Schiller has an interesting thought, I think is interesting, in his letters on the education of man, which is that really to achieve a political and historical and maybe revolutionary transition, what you need to achieve is something like what he calls the aesthetic state. And the aesthetic state is not a state of determination, but of determinability. As he puts it, the aesthetic state is a state equal where man is equal zero, as it were. Now, I think that's an interesting idea, that art, as it were, is there not to produce further determinations, but to undo determinations in order to produce a state of determinability and not determination. And that this aesthetic state has a political or historical, maybe even revolutionary relevance as a state of transition. So that would be my answer.